So imagine if you could have a virus that infected everybody with the history of the world. Hello and welcome to Terrifying Robot Dog. I'm Jonathan Stark.
And I'm Kelly Shaver.
And we're here to talk about how technology is changing the way we interact with the world. This week, we talk about storing GIFs in our DNA. Please stay tuned. Terrifying Robot Dog is next.
What could possibly go wrong?
Yes. Can we just start off by saying that we recognize that not everyone pronounces it GIF?
Yeah.
We don't really want to talk about that.
Yeah, we don't. I know even you and I disagree on that, so.
Yes, I play a guitar, so.
Yeah.
But I've also seen a giraffe.
Exactly.
And the guy that created him says it rhymes with peanut butter.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, hey, anyway, we can go back and forth pronouncing it our own ways and just really drive people crazy.
We could, yeah.
Well, that's not the crux of the news, though.
Do we have any housekeeping before we dive in, since we didn't record last week?
Oh, right. I was on vacation. I think we warned people, but yeah, I was off in the woods for a full week. The most disconnected I've been in easily a decade, probably 20 years.
Yeah, I think I saw you on the internet for like 10 minutes one day.
Mm. We were 10 miles from any kind of paved road or supermarket or gas station or cell phone signal. But they did have a Wi-Fi access point connected to satellite that gave a sort of a weak 2G connection sometimes. So I was able to send a couple text messages, but it was totally unreliable though. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like there's a funny comic somewhere that I think it's the Oatmeal, where like you're better off having no internet connection than a bad one.
Yeah, exactly. A bad one's just frustrating.
So frustrating. And like the genius that I am, more like Nutty Professor, I left my bag behind in the remote hunting lodge. So I've been using my iPad all week because my main computer did not get FedEx to me until today.
Oh.
But I didn't even, until about an hour ago, so I don't even have it. So I've been limping along on my iPad and Erica's laptop.
Oh, well, at least you were able to get it back, though.
Yes. That was actually was more concerned about getting the bag back.
Than the laptop?
Yeah, it's a nice leather bag I got for Christmas.
Nice.
So anyway, but yeah, it was returned in delightful condition, I'm told.
That's good.
Hence, my sound probably is not so great right now. Do we have other housekeeping? I think we crossed 30 email list subscribers.
Yeah, we did. And since we didn't do a podcast last week with you and I decided to go on a different one.
All right. What do we have there? What can you tell us?
Yes, the Developer on Fire podcast, which I believe you have been on in the past.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that episode will be airing Monday.
Cool. And what did you guys talk about?
We talked about it's more of a personal type interview sort of thing where we just kind of talked about stuff I'm passionate about in tech and screw-ups I've made along the way and cool stuff that I've done and just that sort of stuff. It was good.
Cool. So kind of biographical.
Yeah.
Excellent. That's cool. All right. Well, looking forward to listening to that. I wonder if I'll be in for a surprise.
Yeah. Well, I don't think there's anything there that will be a surprise to you. There might be to some other people. I really enjoyed it. But I'm wondering now if I'm going to listen to it Monday and go, oh, why did I say that? But there it is.
I've
it's
never
all
done
out
that.
There. So.
Right. Uh-huh. Yeah. Sometimes that'll bite you.
Yeah, we'll see.
Well. Welcome to oversharing land.
Yes.
So the jumping off point for this week's show was something that came across our radar in the news that is, I can't decide if it's terrifying or eye-opening or mind-blowing. It's certainly mind-blowing.
I think it's all of those things.
Mm. And it makes me wish I paid more attention in chemistry class in high school.
Right.
Because this is a lot more interesting than I ever thought chemistry could be. That's for sure. Never mind biology. So maybe I'll just lead with the headline. So we saw this article that is entitled, Scientists Upload a Galloping Horse GIF into Bacteria with CRISPR.
Yes, and we've talked about CRISPR briefly in the past, and the general consensus then was we don't entirely know what we're talking about.
Yes.
But
there's sort of a data science, very computery kind of thing happening here. But just to give people a quick, not even a crash course, but CRISPR is this sort of like tool that scientists are using to combine like proteins and RNA to go cut or edit DNA strands.
Yeah, it's gene editing.
Yeah, and what this article is about is a sort of gimmicky demonstration of how incredibly accurate it is. So just to paint a picture or paint an animation.
Paint a GIF.
Yeah. You're not going to GIF me?
No, I'm not going to GIF you. I thought about it.
So I don't know where I've seen this particular one before, but it looks like an old-timey animation of a jockey riding a horse.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's kind of famous. I've seen it somewhere before. But anyway, they took the information encoded in that particular animation and they CRISPRed it into some DNA molecules in, I believe it was an E. coli virus.
Yes.
And they this is where it gets wild, I think. Well, it's everything about it. It's wild. But this this is the thing that's like magical to me is that it's just the concept of DNA at all. So even though they sort of grafted this DNA and they just injected some raw random data into it, as the generation, as the virus sort of died off and grew and, you know, it's like a couple of days later, maybe hours, I don't know. It's none of the cells that were originally modified. It grew.
Mm-hmm.
And it's by the time, you know, after a little while, it's all brand new cells. And the DNA is still the same. It's still got the edits. And so they took and decoded it. And you can, there's a little bit of noise, but you can completely see that the data survived a few generations of E. coli, you know, ancestry.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was about to say. I think, isn't that one of the main things about CRISPR that's supposed to make it so powerful is that it does these edits at, I believe they said, the mitochondrial level, so that it's not just a one-time edit. It's genetically the changes are inherited.
I don't know. I don't know if that's specific to this.
I think it's specific to CRISPR.
Well, it's impressive, let me tell you. So, you know, there's some other things that they, you know, this is gimmicky, obviously, but they also happen to mention that scientists have already used DNA to encode all of War and Peace. You know, it's like 600,000 words or
right,
so.
Yeah.
And there's another example. I think the listing all the plant material in the seed vault.
Mm.
So
wild.
It's this. Yeah. I mean, this is so interesting. And let's just say this works. It does work, but let's just say it becomes like feasible to have like, oh, I don't know, like your private key stored in your DNA. And you have some mechanism that makes it reasonably easy to, you know, IO. You have like an input-output mechanism for getting data off of your DNA.
Right. Your fingerprint scanner isn't scanning your fingerprint. It's reading your DNA.
Right. Like a thumb drive, an organic thumb drive baked into
your thumb,
every cell of your body. Yeah, right. A thumb drive. That's where it would be, of course.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so funny.
Yeah, I mean, how did you go down that road and not think of that?
I'm going to pretend I did it on purpose.
Okay.
So this is just like crazy. The implications are just crazy interesting. Because, of course, that's the direction we're going in terms of making that input-output feasible. Mm-hmm. Certainly in the lab first, hospitals next, and then probably doctor's offices, and then in the CVS and a minute clinic. And then eventually it'll be like getting a diabetic blood sugar testing thing.
Right. You'll just put it in a little meter.
Yeah. That's nuts. Like, the first of all, the redundancies, like from a data standpoint, man, the DNA itself is replicated already. So it's already got a baked in backup, but then it's like propagated to, I don't know if it's all your cells or where it lives. If it's just like a free agent roaming around your body, I have no idea, but you know, there's gotta be millions of them. What would be, I don't even know, like, all the ideas are just crazy. Like the first thing we thought about was like, well, this would, you know, makes like espionage interesting.
Mm-hmm. Data smugglers.
Yeah. Like WikiLeaks for somebody's DNA. How would you catch that? You know, like an old Mission Impossible film with a micro dot in somebody's shoe heel. You know?
Right.
Now it's like you can store a giant novel's worth of information completely in a way that seems completely undetectable, although I'm sure as this technology gets created, the detection will also become a thing. But like, ugh. So, okay, so let's just say you had this place to securely store information that is super duper private. So it could be like private keys for whatever, for accessing whatever, email servers or
bank
web servers.
Or, yeah.
Yeah. Or it could be where you keep your Bitcoin private key. And, oh, by the way, automatically pass it down to your kids.
Yeah, that's wild.
Yeah. The properties of DNA are super interesting. Mm-hmm. If you, and then you think, okay, because we're used to the concept of like a static storage device. That's pretty normal. So like what talk about leaving a legacy, you know, like, oh, you're just decode your DNA and there's the private key for our family tree's money, you know, currency.
That's wild, because then you run into things. It's like, well, do we have dominant and recessive data?
Oh man, yeah.
Yeah, like how does that work?
Like, oh, I got the blue eyes, but you got all the money.
Right.
I don't even know. I mean, I'm just so fascinated by the notion of
DNA as a storage mechanism.
Yeah, and like. And combining those two things, I mean, it is already obvious. I mean, that's its purpose, is to have like the blueprints for the instructions for RNA to go running around. Yeah, exactly. But you could store it anywhere. Like you could have like a petri dish full of E. coli that's just like, or a yeast in your refrigerator. Data stored on it. I can't even get my head around it all the way.
Yeah, like they were talking in the article about, oh, now that we can store video and moving images in it, there's the potential to have like biological cameras and things. And I can't get my head around that. Because I mean, yeah, you're talking about there's all kinds of redundancy when you're talking about storing something in DNA just due to its, you know, its nature of replicating and that sort of thing. But at the same time, it also feels fragile because it's organic material. It has to have food and oxygen and water and all these things to sustain it.
Right. But I keep on thinking about this pseudoscience loony bin book I read years ago.
Mm-hmm.
That was about, I don't even remember it 100% clearly, but it was, the premise was, it was presented as science, but it was basically sci-fi. And the premise was that every couple billion years or whatever, there's a cataclysm, like a much bigger than the asteroid that created Gulf of Mexico, like a cataclysmic event where like the skin of the Earth completely rotates around the core, the molten core, like an orange mm-hmm. skin, just like slipping, and it, you know, and hijinks ensue, you know, like
right.
like everything's wiped. And so a big premise of the book is like, imagine if you knew that there was a cataclysmic event on the horizon. What would you do to store the knowledge of humanity, such as it was at the time, to survive that cataclysmic event? So, you know, in the author tries to make a case that the pyramids are like pointing at a place in the sky that tells you a thing, and, you know, and Atlantis was a real thing, and society was way more advanced in the past, you know, way, way in the mm-hmm. past than it is now, but all that was wiped out, and now we started over from scratch. And how would we not start over from scratch? Assuming that humans, and what I keep thinking is, if you assume that at least a couple humans survive, or, you know, a couple million, let's say, I don't know how many, I don't know what the lowest number necessary would be.
We've had near extinction events before that have wiped out all but a very small number of humans on the planet. I don't remember what that number was, but it was a surprisingly small number.
Probably bigger than two, but let's just say, man, that'd be a lot of work. So it's always been in the back of my mind that, like, what would I do? Like, what would I do if we're not interplanetary? Because that would kind of solve the problem. Where, you know, like, all of this knowledge that is accumulated on the web, which is amazing. What if, you know, just electricity ceased to exist? Like, boom, all gone. As soon as you, like, if you have an event that essentially destroys the grid somehow. Now, okay, electricity is gone. How do we even have information to figure out how to get back to electricity?
Right.
Because it's probably all on the web now, or digital, in some digital form that's not accessible. So I always notice when there are these, I mean, how the hell would decode DNA in that situation?
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. How would you decode the DNA?
I don't know. It's just one of those things that's always occurred to me. I'm like, wow, this is the last thing I would have thought of, to have like a persistent record of technological progress, let's just say. And, you know, I would, my thinking always went to things like, you know, I've seen things like, they do these laser etched crystal things that are almost at the microscopic level. Not, you can actually read them with a naked eye with a powerful magnifying glass,
mm-hmm.
but they can etch an incredibly high amount of information, and they're super, super resilient. So I look at things like that. I'm like, oh, that's an interesting method. But that's like a very hardened kind of, it's like I always in the past tried to think of a way that would make something really resistant to damage. But this is more like, instead of being resistant to damage or hardened, it's more like,
just so prolific.
Prolific, right? It feels more like the web, where or the internet anyway, where it's just so, there's just so many nodes, and you only need like one. Or what's it more like? It's more like BitTorrent. So imagine if you could have a virus that infected everybody with the history of the world. I mean, it seems feasible, because I assume a virus, once it's in your body, it's got its own, like, I wonder how many different kinds of DNA are floating around in your body, because it's not just yours.
Do viruses? I don't think viruses have DNA, do they?
What's E. coli? A bacteria. But so you've got a bacteria. So what if you've got this sort of non-harmful bacteria? Everybody's, you know, like a flu vaccine. Oh, here comes a conspiracy theory. You get the vaccinations when you're a kid. One of the things you're vaccinated with is a bacteria that has the history of the world up to that point.
Yeah, that's
so everybody's
that's a nice,
got it stored in there.
That's a nice conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
And I was wrong. Some viruses do have DNA, but not all of them.
Hmm. Well, and I'm sure there are different capabilities, like storage. You know, mm-hmm. like some of them are 64 gig, some of them are 4 gig.
I don't understand. Like, how do you pump a bunch of extra data into some DNA without destroying what's there? Or
I think what I read was that something like 98% of it's not used. I think that's what I read. I'm probably wrong.
That seems, but that's wild in and of itself, because it just seems really, in an evolutionary way, sort of wasteful. Like, why would we hang on to this stuff if we're not using 98% of it? Why wouldn't that 98 disappear over the billions of years we've been evolving?
Right. Maybe I read that wrong, or maybe I misunderstood it, but I definitely saw that percentage. But so there is a scary part to this story, which is that they interviewed the scientist who did this animation storage thing, storage and recovery. And he was like, you know, obviously this is just sort of a gimmick to indicate how much data can be stored and how accurately it can be recovered.
Right. Proof of concept.
Right. But what we really want to do, practical application of this, is that we want to use this accuracy of this storage mechanism as an audit trail for the development of neurons in the human brain, so that we can, across a longitudinal timescale, we can go back through the log of the development.
Like, grip the log of your brain development.
Yeah.
That's wild.
So I'm like, okay, so I realize that, you know, I'm about to say something that's just dumb.
Okay.
But it feels like it's going in the direction of an audit trail of your thoughts. That's a dumb thing to say. But, you know, it's like saying by looking at someone's, telephone, you can tell what they said on it. Like, it's two different things. You're looking at two different things. But when you throw AI in there and you're like, all of a sudden you're tracking this data that could never be tracked. Because you just couldn't have someone hooked up to a machine the whole time. Like, I suppose if you did have someone hooked up to a machine for their whole lives, then maybe you could get this information. I'm not sure.
And, you know, maybe there's
be invasive or what, but
maybe there's patterns and things and that we can get out of that we're just not aware of, because we don't have that much data. Maybe you can.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Read more than just the physical development of a neuron. Maybe there is more of a story there, because I don't think it's really well understood how things like memories and what have you are stored. So, you know, maybe once we were gathering all of this data, patterns would emerge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe you'd just be able to see all the gifts someone ever looked at. It'd be like your browser history.
Somehow I doubt it's that simple, but the idea is hilarious.
Yeah. It's not what this person's trying to do. I mean, this guy's a scientist, and he just wants to get, like,
understand brain development. Yeah.
Yeah. Which totally makes sense. But just the idea of having a recording mechanism that is not under your control in your brain, that someone is going to then download, is like, what? I honestly think that as I was reading this, there's so much science to it that it's almost impenetrable.
Yeah.
But it is really interesting, because I find myself reading words that I know, but then I'm like, well, wait a second. It's deoxyribonucleic acid, but isn't DNA a protein? And I'm like, oh, no, it's a molecule. Well, what's a chromosome, actually? I know that word, but, mm-hmm. oh, it's a long strand of molecules. And I'm like, oh, man, it's weird to have, like, it's like I have, you know, the vocabulary of all of these things, but don't really know what they are in any meaningful way.
I might have understood it slightly better when I was 17.
Yeah, right. Like, the last time I looked at any of this stuff was junior year of high school.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I was not interested in it whatsoever.
Right.
So, but now I'm super fascinated by it, but I just feel like I'm so far behind that it's like, what's the point? But
yeah,
man, it's so weird to see, it's, you know, biology and chemistry moving into tech in a big way. This feels, all of this feels very, very lab rat to me, though. Like, mm-hmm. if it doesn't feel empowering in any way.
No, not
for
yet.
For the average person.
Not yet, no.
Yeah.
No, it's very interesting to think. It feels very lab rat, and it still feels like we're just at the very beginning stages.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, come back in 75 years and we may have something.
Yeah, this is just amazing. Here's one thing. Maybe we should wrap up, but here's the sentence that I think, the paragraph that I think kind of scared me.
Okay.
One day, Invala thinks scientists will be able to use that system to record synaptic activity. Like a guest book at a wedding, embedded signals in the genome could tell researchers exactly which neurons were talking to each other at different times in response to different stimuli. I'm like, if you've got that data, there's no telling what you could actually find in the yeah. patterns.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, again, even if you think there's nothing there to be found as far as, oh, understanding thoughts or what people were thinking at the time, we've never had access to that kind of data before, so we don't really know.
Yeah. I mean, like, people are worried about, like, Facebook cookies.
Right.
Things in your head.
I mean, in all likelihood, these scientists have not just developed a technology for reading your thoughts. Like, realistically, that is likely not going to happen. But the fact is that when you gain access to huge amounts of data that you've never had access to before, you're going to discover new things out of that. And some of it's going to be good. I'm sure most of it's going to be good. But, you know, maybe there will be something there that's a little too intrusive or a little disturbing.
Mm. So here's the thing about reading. So the thought reading thing, I wonder if it's a little bit of a red herring, because I suppose it depends on how things, oh man, this gets straight into law and ethics, like, mm-hmm. really fast. But for a broad range of use cases, it doesn't matter if you can read someone's thoughts, if you can predict their behavior. And who cares? You know what I mean? It doesn't matter what led up to
them doing the thing. Yeah.
Them doing the thing, right?
Right.
So if you can predict, without reading their thoughts, but if you can recognize a pattern in the way somebody's synapses are firing or misfiring.
That leads to a behavior.
That leads to a behavior.
That's a good point.
It doesn't really matter that if you know, like, what words they said in their own head.
Right, or what motivated them or how they felt about it. It's just that you have, okay, this stimuli resulted in patterns of neurons firing that resulted in this, that ended in this result. So...
Right.
I mean, it's the same. Isn't that the same kind of theory as, like, machine learning? It's like, oh, this is the outcome you want. Here's your input. You know, look at these responses and see. And, like, the computer doesn't care about anything other than the computer doesn't care why or even other consequences, really, other than just say, okay, I got this outcome and I'm going to do things that reinforce that.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It doesn't make a moral judgment about it.
Right.
Wild.
Who knows, 50 years from now, maybe we're all just walking around DNA fully loaded with cat GIFs, and we'll all just be sharing our funny cat, our unique and personal funny cat GIFs with everyone.
Yeah, I feel like that would tickle.
You know, it might.
Fuzzy cats moving around inside.
Yeah, kittens.
So cute. So cute when they're in your cells. Oh, man. I'm like, now I can't get out of this. I can't stop thinking about it.
Yeah.
It's like, do you leave DNA behind it all over the place? Like,
mm-hmm.
like if you drink a soda and throw the can away, like, there's DNA in that, isn't there? I mean,
if we were encoding data in there, it could be stolen very easily.
I suppose, yeah. Oh my God, I can't even.
Yeah, this is why we're probably not going to be walking around with a bunch of data encoded inside of us. But it is interesting for the medical applications, and like they were talking about DNA as a storage mechanism or as a sensor type, organic sensors and that sort of thing for other uses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's almost as a storage mechanism for, as a sort of backup method for public information, it's almost more interesting, mm-hmm. I suppose.
Yeah, we're all walking Wikipedias.
Or blockchain. it actually feels kind of similar to blockchain in a way. Okay, I can't even go there. Anyway, it's certainly interesting, certainly thought provoking. So hopefully people are just like, man.
Yeah, if nothing else,
thinking, man, I'm old.
Yeah, if nothing else, it opens a world of possibility for some cool sci-fi stories.
Yeah, that's for sure. I think I tweeted recently that it's hard to imagine that philosopher won't make a comeback as a job title.
Right.
Ethics is almost not enough.
No, there's just so much more to think about.
Yeah. It gets down to like, what's identity? What's human? Anyway, well, it seems like science is marching forward. At any rate, that's our show for this week. I'm Jonathan Stark.
And I'm Kelly Shaver.
And we hope you join us again next week for Terrifying Robot Dog. Bye.
Bye.
Would you like to join the teeming masses who have asked Kelly and I into their inbox every week? Get new episodes delivered straight to you with show notes, links to additional content, and oh, so much more. Plus, you can reply to any message to suggest topics for future episodes. To get the inside track, go to terrifyingrobotdog.com and look for the Keep Me in the Loop button. That URL again is terrifyingrobotdog.com.
It's in your DNA.